This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Nation, welcome to the latest episode of PTVN Rewind. This is the monthly show where we take a look back at historic wrestling pay-per-view cards from the past. I'm Ben Morse. I'm your host. I can be heard regularly on PTVN's main event. And this month, we are going into somewhat uncharted territory. We're going to WCW in the year 2000 and taking a look at Spring Stampede. It was the first pay-per-view co-promoted, booked by Eric Bischoff and Vince Russo. In many ways, I think it was seen as the last gasp WCW had to take back the prominence they had had only a couple years earlier against the WWF. For those of you who are wrestling historians, or I think most of us, you know where it ended up, but we're going to cover the show tonight. There's a lot to talk about. There are a lot of interesting characters, angles, behind-the-scenes stuff, lots to delve into. For that, we got a three-man booth. Joining me first, we have never worked together. I am excited to have a Sunday afternoon conversation with him. That's one of the guys who is responsible for the PTVN comic section, of course, a topic near and dear to my heart, one of the hard-traveling fanboys, and that is Greg Phillips.
Hey, Ben, how's it going, man? Never spoken to you before.
I know. This is big. We've been on Skype for only a couple minutes before this started. We dove right in, so Greg and I are getting to know each other right before your ears.
It's going to be an incredibly entertaining prospect for all you great listeners out there in the PTVN universe. I'm not going to make that a thing.
No, let's try it. The PTVN neighborhood.
There we go.
Yeah. And the other guy who's going to be with us today, someone I am very familiar with, my amigo, my bro, the guy who I speak to every time we do PTVN main event, who I communed with in New Orleans over a year ago now, and that is the I'm gonna call him the king of the bayou, the swamp king, Andrew Reich.
Hey, how's it going, Ben? And also, I have never spoken to you either.
See, Reich, I know your whole gimmick is no selling what was said before you, but I literally just went on for like a minute about how we know each other.
Oh yeah,
I totally felt that. But you know what? If you didn't do that, you wouldn't be you, and I love you, so I appreciate it.
Love you too.
All right, before we dive in, I am going to have Andrew. He has prepared a little kind of overview of the Nitro that took place before this pay-per-view to get you guys who maybe were not watching familiar. But even before we do that, I want to go around the horn, and I think it's important whenever we do a rewind to give context of where we were as fans when this show took place. Andrew, because we're going to come back to you in a sec, I want to start with you. Where were you in April of 2000? What were you watching? What was your relationship with wrestling?
Well, everybody who was a wrestling fan at this point in early 2000 would be lying if they said that they were not in a good place when it came to watching professional wrestling, because even though ECW was getting close to its dying days and WCW was, you know, going down for the count pretty quickly, the WWF was so strong that every week you were watching WWF TV and there was something great to watch. And WCW was in a weird place, but I was always fascinated with what they would try to do to stay at least even riding the coattails of the WWF while they were launching into the mainstream by that point. So, you know, WCW was trying a lot of different things in late 1999 and then in early 2000. So I was almost as fascinated with watching what WCW was doing than I was what the WWF was doing, because I knew with the WWF I was always going to watch something great. With WCW, I had no idea what I was in for. So I was kind of half and half here with WCW and WWF, even though the WWF was just kicking WCW's ass across the board.
Yeah, Andrew, you and I have both spoken on multiple occasions. We've both written pieces on how kind of 2000, 2001 WCW was fascinating just because they had their backs against the wall. They were throwing stuff to see what sticks. So that's definitely something we'll dig into here. Now, Greg, on the other hand, where were you as a wrestling fan in regards to WWF, WCW, and just what were you watching in 2000?
I've kind of always been, I guess, one of those uber wrestling nerds that tries to watch as much of it as I can, regardless of quality. And in 2000, I was probably at the peak of that. Like I was still riding high from the Monday Night War era and everything. And even though WCW was pretty well, even though I was a huge WCW fan, I kind of knew that they were not going to come back and end up overtaking the WWF. Didn't think they'd go out of business eventually either, but I was watching every Nitro, every Thunder, every Raw, every SmackDown, every ECW on TNN. I pretty much just couldn't get enough of wrestling. And even in WCW, I could recognize when the shows were really bad, as they were for the first few months of 2000. But there were still enough performers in WCW that I was connected to, that I loved, that I wanted to follow and enjoyed seeing them perform, that I was always able to get something out of the shows. Like, even if the show was bad, I knew I could get a good Booker T match, or I could get a good Scott Steiner promo or whatever. So I was pretty well invested in both shows, kind of obviously much more enjoying the WWF at that time, but I was not going to give up on WCW.
Yeah, it's an interesting point you made there, Greg, about how you had a sense they weren't going to come back, but you didn't think they were going to go out of business. Because the thing was, you know, from the 80s, mid-80s up through the late 90s or mid-90s, the status quo for WCW was they were always a solid number two. I think it was really that period from 96 to 98 where they suddenly became the number one company. It kind of it made things odd when they went back to being number two. Things weren't the same. I mean, it should have in many ways just been like, okay, well, we're back to the status quo. But because they had tasted that success of being the top company in wrestling, I think something always felt off. They couldn't go back to being like, you know, 1992 WCW. They had to do things like they were going to cover here, where it was dramatic, drastic shifts, not just to try to stay afloat, but to try to get back into that number one position, and may have ultimately what led to their demise. Now, the month before this, Uncensored 2000 was kind of an odd, just, you know, standard WCW show. Sid was the world champion. Jeff Jarrett was feuding with him. Hogan and Flair were on top. It was very much the archetype of the type of show that people criticize WCW for. But a couple weeks after that, things happened backstage where Vince Russo and Eric Bischoff, both of whom had been ousted the year before, came back into power, but came back into power together. And this is basically supposed to be the dream team that was going to fix everything. And Andrew, I want you to walk us through the Nitro that took place less than a week before the Spring Stampede pay-per-view. What happened and how did it lead us to the show we're going to cover today?
Well, I don't want to get too much into it, but I do want to, before I talk about the Nitro before Spring Stampede 2000, I do want to skip over into the fall of 1999, because that's when Eric Bischoff, like you had mentioned, got ousted as the creative director, and they brought in not only Vince Russo, but also Ed Ferrara, who were both writers in the WWF at the time, and took over the WCW creative programming. They were nicknamed the Powers That Be. by the time we got to the show Sold Out, which was the first pay-per-view in the year 2000, Vince Russo was ousted by the booking committee at WCW due to a lot of different rebookings that he had to do for that show because Bret Hart, who was the champion, got injured with a concussion, and Goldberg broke his wrist because he did some stupid thing with a limousine and kind of really random things like that. So on the night of Sold Out, the booker who wound up booking not only Sold Out but also Super Brawl and the Uncensored show that you mentioned was Kevin Sullivan, who had been an assistant agent for WCW for a long, long time. And the shows that, I think Greg could speak for me too, is that the first three shows in 2000, specifically Uncensored, were like the worst shows humanly possible that WCW could have done. So at the time that Bischoff and Russo took over or were announced to be coming back into the fold, I was glad as hell because Sullivan shows were so awful, and it felt like the Nitro that they introduced Russo and Bischoff back into the fold was kind of a breath of fresh air.
Speaking of Sullivan, I was going to say four words that everybody listening to this needs to look up if they don't make any sense to them. Yappapai Indian strap match, brother.
And unbelievably, Yappapai is one word.
I was going to say, is Yappapai one word? We've already
a lot of hype here. Applepai Indian strap match for a long time, but
it's the word. The Yappapai Indian strap match between Hogan and Flair is like awful. Sid was the champion. I think Sullivan did have an idea in mind of what he wanted to do for Spring Stampede in regards to some of the people that we're going to talk about as we go into the show, and maybe I'll bring them up every now and then. But Russo and Bischoff come in, and they had the Nitro show in Denver, Colorado, before the Spring Stampede pay-per-view. Russo and Bischoff are both introduced, and they were kind of promoting the idea that they were going to feud with one another as bookers and on-air characters. Surprisingly, they linked them together in a union, and they announced that the standard bearers who had been on top in WCW for so long, people like Hulk Hogan, Lex Luger, Sting, Diamond Dallas Page, Macho Man Randy Savage, they were going to be on the outs in terms of their clout. This is all storyline based. This is not backstage. And they were going to bring in all these kind of younger, or I guess I should say fresher faces into the main event scene. And they put them into one collective and called them the New Blood, or in some cases I heard them called the New Breed of WCW. And they would come in, and they had a WCW. What they also did that was very controversial is that Russo stripped all of the championships in the first segment of the Nitro, including Jeff Jarrett, who was the U.S. champion. He is stripped of the belt. Sid, controversially, is stripped of the belt, where Bischoff name drops the scissors incident that Sid had with Arn Anderson, which was one of those kayfabe no-nos about when Arn Anderson was stabbed with the scissors by Sid back in 1993 in London, England. And it was like a real, like, drop the mic, ooh, type of moment for a lot of the smart fans. But anyways, Sid is stripped of the world title. They stripped the tag titles. I don't even remember who the tag champs were.
Harris Boys.
The Harris Twins.
Yeah.
Oh,
and,
God.
And then the cruiserweight belt. The main part of the Nitro and the Thunder that followed after that, because they did have a Thunder show on Wednesday nights at the time, was the world title tournament. And I don't remember the rounds per se, but the finals wound up being Diamond Dallas Page versus Jeff Jarrett.
And right. The idea was, they said from the start, Jeff Jarrett, who was their main guy, the chosen one, was going to be in the match for the world title at Spring Stampede. And they basically just made the other guys, who I don't know if you mentioned it yet or not, the older guys were called the Millionaires Club. Mm-hmm. They made them fight each other in a tournament to try to earn the right to face Jarrett at Spring Stampede.
Yes. So the script got drastically flipped in terms of, like, the top guys having to fight their way back up, and then the people that were always mid-carders and low-carders, who people had thought would never get the chance, all of a sudden being kind of pimped as these new school type of main eventers in WCW. Whether they were ready or not is a different story. But it was just a very, very wild, wacky show. You could tell that Russo kind of like wrote this as his opus coming back. I know Bischoff was involved in some way with communicating with the wrestlers, but the writing, I mean, is all Russo here. A lot of interference, a lot of crazy backstage segments, a lot of blood, a lot of profanity.
The heels presented as faces and the faces presented as heels.
Yeah,
That's something I want to talk about in a sec, actually, once you wrap up, Andrew. That's the first topic I want to cover.
Yeah, the kind of like the shooty type of promos, like Scott Steiner put on Ric Flair, Shane Douglas the same. Yep. I'm trying to remember a few of the other ones that they had that were kind of like, ooh, that seemed a little bit harsh.
I mean, they basically did a lot of one-to-one stuff where it was for every Millionaires Club guy, there was a New Blood counterpart who was feuding with him.
Yes.
Some of those were very, you know, very storyline, like Lex Luger and Buff Bagwell or Vampiro and Sting. But a lot of them were a lot closer to home. And that's the guys like, you know, Shane Douglas and Ric Flair, which was very personal, or Hulk Hogan and Billy Kidman, which was directly based on an interview Hogan had given in real life, non-kayfabe, where he, you know, basically buried Kidman as a draw. So it was that kind of walking the line between shoot and real life. And by the end of the show, the established thing we had was the Millionaires Club were the baby faces, the New Blood were the heels, which felt a little backwards. And I think that was what you were kind of talking about, Greg. And I want you to speak a little bit more to that, because to me, it did. This was the first time we saw this with kind of pitting all the younger characters in a promotion against the older guys. It's not the last time we'd see it, but inevitably what seems to happen is the veterans, who the fans are familiar with, whether by design or whether by that's just how we're trained, those are the guys we cheer for, whereas the younger guys end up being the heels by default. Was that necessarily what WCW needed at this time in your eyes?
No, and as somebody who watched, as far as I can remember, watched every single Nitro, every single Thunder, most Saturday nights, even the worldwide show that was just syndicated and you know, had a lot of jobber matches, I can tell you that one of the things that I, as a diehard WCW fan, had been screaming about from probably about mid-98 on, if not earlier, was that WCW failed to establish their younger superstars as being on the superstar level of the Hogans, the Flairs, the Stings, the Lugers, the Goldbergs, the DDPs. And you had guys like Raven and Jericho and Chris Benoit and Eddie Guerrero and Perry Saturn, Dean Malenko, that all kind of fell by the wayside. And so by 2000, when Russo and Bischoff were coming in and overhauling everything, I thought, okay, Russo had gone on record and talked about how important it was to establish the younger wrestlers. And I thought, well, maybe this will be a chance for the guys like Booker T, the guys, you know, even the guys that weren't necessarily young but were fresh, guys mm-hmm. like people will laugh now, but Jeff Jarrett was a pretty fresh character at that time as far as a main eventer goes.
Scott Steiner.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Scott Steiner was red hot at that time. And I was thinking, okay, we're finally going to have new guys that are going to be able to ascend. Kidman was still around. I think Ray was hurt at that time, but Ray Mysterio, whenever he would come back.
Yeah, there's no filthy animals yet in either of these shows.
Yeah, and so that would, you know, guys like that were the ones that probably needed to get the wagon hitched to him, because Hogan was beyond stale at that point as the Hulkster, and the Flair was on his last legs. He was wrestling in shirts and stuff, which we'll get to a little bit later on.
we will cover that.
Lex Luger was so bloated that he lost all of his mobility and just wasn't believable anymore. Basically, the only of the older guys that could really still go consistently at that time was Sting.
Yeah, and you notice on this show, he wrestles more matches than any other Millionaires Club guys, and that's not an accident.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Vampiro's another guy. But I definitely think that they needed to present it as these guys have been holding down the young talent for a long time, and these young guys are really good. And I think the key to that would have been taking one of the veterans and siding him with the young guys, probably Sting, mm-hmm. because Sting was the most over of the veteran wrestlers. So I would, you know, if they had taken Sting or even Flair and said, look, you're right, these young guys need a chance. And then you had Hogan, of course, going heel and being the leader of the Millionaires Club, saying, this isn't how it works, brother, and go in that direction. But it was ruined from Jump Street, because when you present the established old veterans that can't go anymore as the good guys, you're automatically, yes, the fans are going to cheer them, but you have to condition the fans to go the other way. And I think that it was just a really unfortunate situation that kind of encapsulates exactly what ended up going wrong for WCW in the long term.
Go ahead, Ben.
Okay. Yeah, I think, you know, you're dead on, Greg. And I do think the younger guys need to be the baby faces here. You're right, though. It was hard because people were conditioned to cheer for the old guys. But I think another big problem is, right off the bat, Russo and Bischoff were the stars of the New Blood. They were the centerpiece, no doubt. I mean, you had guys from the Millionaires Club weren't feuding with guys from the New Blood. They were feuding with Russo and Bischoff. And what that did was made guys like Jarrett, Steiner, Kidman, Vampiro, they weren't their own characters. They weren't fighting to be stars. They were lackeys for Russo and Bischoff. And Russo and Bischoff were so hateable. You know, they're hated characters that it made them the bad guys by default. It would have been interesting, like you said, to have Russo and Bischoff come back and say, you know, whether you split them or whether you don't, bottom line, they have to be the ones saying, we made a lot of money with these guys, with Hogan and Flair and these guys, and we're sticking with them. And you have, maybe you do have Sting. I think Sting would have been a great choice basically to say, like, look, it's time to pass the torch. These are the guys. And you do flip this feud. I think everyone's fantasy booked it then. And, you know, it's easy to say that with years and years of hindsight. I do think one thing we're underestimating is that maybe the crowd was gonna root for Ric Flair against Shane Douglas no matter what. But I think there's something to it. What did you want to say, Andrew, before we start diving into the show itself?
Well, just 2 points. One of them is that, and I know it's sort of fighting a losing battle part two with Vince Russo when he was a TNA, but I think everybody would nod in agreement and know that he kind of went back to this storyline in like late 08, early 09 with
he went directly back to it.
With the storyline called the Main Event Mafia. Mm-hmm. And it was basically the Millionaires Club, if they were the heels with the championship belts, and the New Blood, which they call TNA Frontline, was the baby faces. They did it a little better though, because they did a better job of mixing the veterans with the youngsters in the frontline part of the storyline, the protagonist.
Yeah.
But the antagonists, the Millionaires Club, were all big time main eventers. And I thought that Main Event Mafia thing worked a lot better. So I agree with Greg that it was shot from Jump Street because of the fact that they pitted the roles the wrong way. The only other thing I wanted to mention is that a big part of what happened with with Russo's ouster and a lot of the young guys getting the opportunity with the New Blood storyline is that they didn't really have a lot of those great mid-carders that had built the WCW in 1998, 1997.
I'm going to stop you right there because that's something I want to cover at the end of the show.
Okay, we're going to stop with that one.
We're going to get to that, though, believe me.
Basically,
that's a big question.
If those specific people had not bailed after Kevin Sullivan took over, this storyline could have been drastically
different. That's what we're going to talk about once we get through the show.
Yes.
So I'm going to put the muzzle on you for a sec, Grish, but I'm going to take it right off. Don't you worry. let's get into the show itself. Spring Stampede 2000. The way the show was structured was, in addition to the world title match we knew we were getting, which was Diamond Dallas Page against Jeff Jarrett, basically the show was promoted as, we are going to fill all these titles we just vacated. You guys, either of you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think at the time, you know, they very loosely said what was going to happen. You know, they basically just said there's going to be matches. Yeah. They said who was going to be vying for the titles. They didn't announce specifically, you know, first round matches in the tournament, but there's a tag title tournament, a very small tournament. It's only 3 matches. There's a U.S. title tournament, which dominates the bulk of the show. There's a match for the hardcore title. There's a match for the cruiserweight title. And then, interestingly enough, there's a match between Jimmy Hart and Mankow, which we're going to try to gloss over as best we can. But
Tony Schiavone, right in the beginning, says, wrestling matches, forget about it.
Yeah, and it's very prophetic because just everything I just mentioned right there, you know, from the bat. And, you know, this is something Russo is infamous for to begin with. Not a lot of long wrestling matches on the show. There's a lot of segments. There's a lot of interview time. There's a lot of non-wrestling things to take place. As a promotion that's trying to rebrand and take back their spot from WWF, Reesh, what did you think of kind of this being the kind of show they were going to present, where it was just very crash TV, very quick matches, a lot of storyline, a lot of feuds, and not necessarily a lot of in-ring stuff? As a fan, was this the type of thing you wanted to see that made you think, okay, maybe I'll give WCW a shot?
Yes, I actually really was looking forward to it because when Vince Russo came in late 99, a lot of the big wigs like Flair, Hogan, I know Savage showed up for just a second in the New Blood storyline, and then he was gone. And then I'm trying to think of a couple of other ones that were gone as soon as Russo took over because they wanted to either just cash in their paychecks and they didn't want to work with Russo and they were more familiar with Bischoff or whatever the case may be.
Flair and Hogan were the big ones, although I think there was also something to him wanting to develop longer-term storylines with them. But
yeah.
I mean, we'll never know.
Yeah, and so they were doing a lot of the Crash TV there. But I was really fascinated, even though I didn't think Vince Russo was like a creative genius at this time. I thought he was smarter than people were giving him credit for. But I think that what I was really fascinated with watching is what Russo was going to do with the big names now that Bischoff was in the fold, talking the main eventers and the big guaranteed contract wrestlers to stay in the locker room and perform on the shows. And I wanted to see how Vince Russo was going to be able to book with this entire arsenal at his disposal. And even if it failed, I knew it was going to fail spectacularly, and I wanted to watch it.
Greg, same question. What did you think when you got a sense of what kind of show this was going to be? Was it something that intrigued you? Did it turn you off? What did you think?
You know, I'm trying to put myself back in my 16-year-old mind at the time. And as I recall, I was actually really excited for this show because I wanted so badly for WCW to thrive and survive. And so when Russo and Bischoff came back, I was a big Bischoff fan. And so I thought, well, maybe with Bischoff there, along with Russo, it'll be some kind of, you know, superstar creative team like in a comic that will help rejuvenate sales, so to speak, and bring WCW back to where it would compete with WWF again, or at least, you know, become more respectable than they were. So I was really excited about Spring Stampede, and I thought, okay, they're going with a more WWF approach of Crash TV. I didn't realize, of course, that it was the WWF 1999 approach as opposed to the WWF 2000 approach. But it was definitely going to be different than what we had seen in WCW, and I think sometimes different is good. And WCW needed a shock to its system, and maybe this could be that. So going into it, I was really excited, and I was excited about seeing Shane Douglas and Ric Flair in the ring because I bought into all the what if they get into a shoot and all that stuff. So you know, at 16 years old, it was pretty much written directly for me. So I was really looking forward to it.
And I wanted to add that no matter what happened in Spring Stampede 2000, I knew it was going to be better than Uncensored 2000. So
well,
that right off the bat.
All right, Greg gave a good segue there because the first thing I wanted to talk about was – I hesitate to call it the tag team division because, as you said, Reach couldn't even remember who the tag team champions were. And I bet if I pressed you to name the other three or four teams that were tag champs in the first 3 months of 2000, you would struggle as well. But I do want to talk about the tag team title tournament. I think that's a good place to start because, as Greg said, kind of the centerpiece here was Ric Flair and Shane Douglas. You had on one side Team Package, who was an established team here. This was Ric Flair and Lex Luger with Miss Elizabeth as their manager. They had been teaming for months leading up to this as heels. Now they have been flipped over being baby faces. And the impetus for them going into this is that Shane Douglas and Buff Bagwell, they're kind of, you know, if we're going to get into comic stuff, they're basically the Bizarro them on the New Blood side of things. They're on one side of the tag team title tournament. Flair and Luger are on the other. They have to wrestle their opening round matches to get to each other to fill the vacancy of the tag team titles. In the first round, Flair and Bagwell have to go against the Mama Lukes. And then Russo comes out and adds the Harris brothers in, so it's a 4-on-2 handicap match. Which team package wins, which we're going to talk about in a sec. On the other side, you've got Douglas and Bagwell, who have never teamed before, taking on Harlem Heat 2000, who was the former Ahmed Johnson, Big T, and Stevie Ray, managed by the former Clarence Mason, who I don't even remember what his name was in WCW.
Jay Biggs?
Okay. And I know they had Big Cash with them as well. A lot of histrionics. I guess the first place I want to go before we delve into the actual meat of the Flair, Douglas, Russo of it all is you basically got this feud between these two teams with Vince Russo involved as well. And it is the driving force behind the entire tag team portion of this show. In the process, three other teams, think of them what you will, the Harris brothers, the Mamalukes, and Harlem Heat, who were three legitimate tag teams who had, you know, done what they'd done for the first 3 months of 2000, essentially get buried. I mean, the Mamalukes and Harris brothers can't even defeat Team Package 4-on-2, and Harlem Heat can't beat a team that has never teamed before tonight. So you really, it's a case, and we'd see this a lot, of the feud being more important than the division itself. Rish, what did you think about this? I mean, from what you said before, the tag team division was not exactly on fire in 2000 WCW, and frankly, hadn't been, you know, a centerpiece of WCW for years. Did it bother you at all, kind of just jobbing out all the other teams and making these two super teams the focal point, or did you think it was the right way to go?
I don't know if it was the right way to go, but it was predictable from the beginning with Russo, because he had done it with the tag team title belts in 99 when he gave it to the Outsiders and they were feuding with Bret and Goldberg. And Bret Hart and Goldberg, I think, somehow were the tag team champions while they were feuding over the world title. So it was obvious from the beginning that Russo didn't really have that much care for the tag team title belts, given what kind of roster that they had at that time. The one thing I will mention, and you talked about, is that it was very obvious that Russo versus Flair was the real crux of the entire thing, because the moment you turn on the network and you turn on Spring Stampede 2000, the first thing you see is Vince Russo calling Ric Flair from the Nitro show a piece of shit at the bottom of my shoe.
And I'm going to wipe that shit off.
Yeah, and he says, I'm going to call you I'm going to make you my, quote unquote, my New York bitch.
Right, so, which is different than, you know, any other kind of bitch.
Yeah.
Right. Much more accented bitch.
Yeah, mm-hmm. He could be a bitch there. He could be anywhere. And so just random notes really from the tag matches, but in terms of the tag team scene, the Filthy Animals were really good, but the problem was Eddie was gone. I don't know what happened to Conan at this time. I guess he was just sitting on the sidelines.
Contract stuff.
Yeah, so they didn't really have a lot of meat to it, so that's why we wound up with the Harris twins holding the belts arbitrarily, you know, while Sullivan was booking the shows, you know, as part of NWO 2000, and we wound up with a really meaningless tag division by the time Russo and Bischoff got there. With an introduction later in the show of a certain tag team, it gets a little stronger, but it right at this point, it was pretty worthless.
Yeah, Greg, you talked about really being excited to see this Flair versus Douglas feud, and I was the same way. Because, you know, I watched ECW. I knew about this crazy history of Shane Douglas. To me, again, one of the problems with this is, as Andrew mentioned, Flair Douglas never really went anywhere. It immediately became Flair versus Russo. And that happened with a lot of these feuds. We're going to get into more of them. I was interested in that. I was also interested in the fact that it was Flair Russo instead of Flair Bischoff. I kind of feel like there was too much real life bad blood for them to do Flair Bischoff. But right. When they inserted Russo in there, when it became clear that Shane Douglas was not going to be the guy really going after Flair, even if, you know, he was having matches with him, did that kind of harsh your buzz a little bit, or did you still see some potential here?
I think I still saw some potential there. It was weird to me because I felt I'm not really saying this as an indictment on Douglas. It's going to sound like it, but it's really not. By the time Douglas actually started – I missed ECW during most of its prime years. I only started watching when they got on TNN. Mm-hmm. And when I finally saw Shane Douglas pop up in WCW, it was pretty apparent within a few months. And I liked him, but it was pretty apparent that he was not a main event guy. Mm-hmm. And like when he was in there with Flair, I had all this anticipation for it, and we finally get it. And instead of them having a shoot fight, it's just, you know, a normal Ric Flair match.
Right.
And again, no knock on Nate, but he has his style of match. So it's you know, I was that killed it. And then like Douglas, I just didn't see, and it became clear to me the company didn't see Douglas as a top level guy because they put him in a tag team with Bagwell. Yep. And Bagwell was clearly the star of the tag team, the one that got the most attention. So it kind of already was in a bad shape. And I thought Russo was so hateable and such a great heel that it could work out. But and I apologize if we're going to get to this later in the show, but one thing that I noticed in watching this show again is that Russo kind of – a lot of the complaints people have about Stephanie McMahon sometimes applies to Russo tenfold, because he's a heel that never backs down.
Right.
And never lets the faces get any shine at all. I mean,
yeah.
It was hard to buy into the – it was hard to buy that Vince Russo wouldn't be afraid of Ric Flair, who's a multiple-time world champion, but he's not. He's just – he's not afraid of Hogan. He's not afraid of Flair. He's not afraid of any of them, and it kind of it undermines the babyfaces when the heels aren't afraid of them at all.
Yeah, that's something I want to circle back to actually in a larger point in a sec. Before we do that, I do want to kind of – put the tag team division to bed and just note that what Andrew was talking about is Brian Adams and Brian Clark do re-debut here. They're not chronic yet. I don't think they got that tag team Nitro.
Yeah,
right
they in. Didn't say it. They didn't say it yet. No,
they just called. They even called them the Bryans, which I thought would have been a great name.
No, Mark Madden's hilarious because he says that's Brian Adams and Brian Clark, and it's like no, that's Wrath and that's Crush.
But they come in during that final match, and they help Douglas and Bagwell to win the World Tag Team titles. They become the first New Blood champs of the night. You did mention, Greg, we can't go past without mentioning the fact that, yes, Ric Flair does wrestle the entire night in his quote-unquote street clothes. But for Ric Flair, street clothes are like a really nice pair of slacks.
I was about to say that.
A nice polo shirt.
Yeah,
well, it was like, I think they wanted, I mean, the fact was Flair at this time, and I don't know if this was a Bischoff thing, a Russo thing, if it was trying to say like, oh, these guys are gritty. I think it was more, they just didn't want Flair out there in his trunks because he didn't have any confidence in his physique and stuff at this point.
Yeah. Flair says in the promo that he dressed in his quote unquote street clothes because he was ready for a fight and not a wrestling match, and that was like the storyline.
That was the justification. I got the storyline. Yeah. I mean, you had Hogan later do the same thing, but the thing is, Hogan at least has the sense to wear like, you know, black jeans.
Hogan looked like he was ready for a fight. Flair looked like he was ready for a zoning board meeting.
Yeah. So yeah, Flair looks ridiculous,
and he would do this for a while. As I recall, all of Ric Flair's matches for the last year and almost year and a half of WCW were wrestled in a T-shirt, and it was like or a shirt of some kind. And it's really weird because I watched the matches again, and he wasn't in that bad of shape, really.
No, he looks fine. No.
I mean, it was just a weird – maybe it was because of the Triple H interview that he did on the radio show around that time where he was talking about how he loved Flair, but Flair needed to wrestle with a shirt on or whatever.
Yeah. I think there was definitely – it was a lot of factors. I'll ask you this, though. Would it have been weird to see Flair out there in, like, typical, like, street clothes? Like, I'm trying to picture Ric Flair in, like, a cutoff T-shirt and jeans, and it might have been worse.
Like a piss-on Calvin shirt.
Yeah.
or, like, wearing whatever Shawn Michaels wears to street fights.
Exactly.
So, my only random notes from the matches, the three matches with the tag team, first of all, the Mamalukes, who lost that semifinal, they had great theme music.
It did.
Like, they really did. That's the one credit I'll give him music-wise with this one. And also, as old as he was and as run down as he was, Ric Flair could still go in the ring.
Flair went in these matches. There was he was the workhorse of all of these dudes.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah, and if this were a different show, I would plug the PTVN entrance theme tournament here, but we've got too much to cover. So
I was also going to throw a little bit of credit towards my boy, who it's going to be weird to say my boy because nobody else ever liked this guy. I thought Johnny the Bull was awesome back then.
Oh, Johnny the Bull was great. No, you're not alone, Greg. A lot of people like Johnny Stamboli.
And then there's this storyline where Disco Inferno, who is their manager, gets frisked away by these Sicilian. No, the funniest part is these mobsters take him away, and they ask, who are those guys? And Mark Madden goes, I don't know, but they look Sicilian.
Sicilian, I believe is what he said.
All right, what I want to jump to, I'm going to use whatever segues I can here, boys, because we have so much we got to dig into. And what I wanted to jump from here is we were talking about Flair's attire versus Hogan's attire. So Hulk Hogan's not booked on this show for a match, but he does show up, and it's a big plot point. He had been brutalized during the week leading up by Billy Kidman, who I think the infamous comment was Hogan in some radio interview or something had said, basically said, Kidman couldn't sell at a flea market. And so Kidman, with Torrey Wilson on his arm, got turned into the big nemesis against Hogan here. But again, much like with Flair and Russo, it quickly became Hogan versus Bischoff, with Kidman as kind of Bischoff's heavy, which was odd from the start because Hogan's about twice the size, and that's being generous, of Kidman. But what I wanted to talk about was how Bischoff approached his role in terms of being the guy feuding with people, because he would feud with DDP as well, versus how Russo did. Because
that's a good name.
It's a good name. We should save that for Russoff. Something else. But in the same way, Russo refused to, you know, back down from Flair, didn't back down from anybody, you know, really looked like he was the king's shit. Bischoff, you got to throw some praise his way in that he at least seemed terrified of Hogan.
Yes,
totally. And, you know, whether that's because he actually had a good relationship with Hogan, or, you know, he was to me what you wanted the heel authority figures to be here. He was scared of Hogan. He was scared of DDP. So he had to use guys like Kidman and Jarrett to hide behind, whereas Russo, you know, didn't do Douglas and Bagwell any favors. What do you say about that, Rish, about, you know, kind of Bischoff versus Russo in terms of this whole deal?
I think with Bischoff playing, you know, the heel character in an administrative role, it was like putting on a pair of gloves. Like, sure. he did it exactly the way he had done it when he was like the benefactor, whatever you want to call him, of the NWO. He did a great job there. I think that you can be cowardly without giving away all of your heat. Like Greg was saying, you know, they had Russo, like, cause even in the promo at the very beginning, they kind of lay out the storyline that, you know, Bischoff is really has all this trepidation cause he found out that Hogan's out of the hospital from his attack. And Russo's like, don't worry, I'll take care of this. I always have a card up my sleeve. I'm not scared of nothing. And Bischoff is like scared to death. I want to do pipe in and say, as much, I mean, I'm going to be the contrarian here for most people who have opinions about the New Blood at this time, but I really liked how Vince Russo booked Hulk Hogan. He made him look like an angry giant, like Stone Cold Hulk Hogan. Like,
yeah, that was the idea.
You know, it's almost like when Brock Lesnar, you know, does his segments on WWE now. It's got like the shaky cam. He comes in, he just destroys people. He's like a brawler almost. And he's talking all this trash everywhere he's walking. Like, I think he keeps saying that he's going to eat Bischoff's ass.
Yes. He multiple times threatens to eat Bischoff's ass.
He says that Bischoff, he's going to beat him until he smells as bad as Rodman.
It was Hogan's, it was Hogan's American Psycho moment.
Yeah. It's Patrick Bateman. And I really liked it. Like, I liked Hogan coming in angry and having his spot taken away and being betrayed by Bischoff. I thought it was fresh versus having Flair a feud with Bischoff, because we had seen that before. Sure. With Bischoff turning on Hogan and Hogan getting angry at him and being the rebel, I kind of liked it. I think they could have done actually more with it. But Billy Kidman was not really a good person in that role.
I kind of disagree about Kidman, because the one thing that I took away from that segment is I didn't love the backstage stuff where, like, at one point Bischoff's cowering in his locker room and Russo, of course, comes in with the cops and they pull their guns on Hogan while he's threatening to eat Bischoff's ass. And, which is a pretty serious charge, by the way.
Yeah.
But I thought Kidman was great in the beatdown segment. I think you could say that it made him look too weak or whatever. But man, he was selling like
oh, he sold like Shawn Michaels,
and it made Hogan look like a monster, which I didn't think was possible with Hogan at that time. But it was. I agree with you that the segment was good. Like it was an interesting direction for Hogan to take.
Yeah, and you never saw Hogan do table spots. So when he's just beating the crap out of Hogan at the table, it's like, wow, this is violent. I've never seen Hogan like this in a long time.
I agree with both of you guys as far as I think the segment came off great, and I think that the Hogan booking was great. I think Hogan did come off like a monster, and it made him really interesting. The problem was that the end result of this angle, and you could see it from here, was never going to be Billy Kidman getting over. It was going to be Hogan getting over again. And the bottom line there is, you know, Kidman, great wrestler. I think he's one of the more underrated guys of this era. But he just – there was no believable way he could stand in there with Hogan. We're not even talking about, like, you know – the best he was going to do was pull off a fluke win over him, and that's a babyface thing. Heel Kidman against babyface Hogan was just – a weird
never made
feud.
Any sense.
Yeah, it was never going to work. Kidman wasn't the heel. And I think the problem here was I understand why they did what they did. Hogan had made a real life comment about Kidman. So it was a feud that for internet fans, it was interesting. And that was kind of Russo's, you know, it was Russo's bread and butter. It would have made more sense here to have someone who is an actual physical threat for Hogan. And they had a few guys who were going to talk about coming up in the U.S. title tournament who would have probably been a better fit here. You could have had be a real heavy, and they could have gone back and forth, you know, basically let Hogan do what he was used to doing, squashing a monster, and still created this new Hogan character. So I think the booking of Hogan wasn't a problem. The booking of Bischoff wasn't a problem. It was just that Kidman wasn't the guy who was going to get over here. And there were ways for Kidman to get over. Mm-hmm. It just wasn't fighting Hulk Hogan and, you know, looking like he was a little kid trying to beat up an adult.
It was a tough role for Kidman, not only because of his physique, but also his persona was not one to cut heel promos. He was like leading into that time frame in 2000, Billy Kidman was like, you know, an up and coming baby face. The fans love Billy Kidman. And it wasn't just Torrey Wilson. I think people really just enjoyed watching his matches. And then now all of a sudden he's like the bread and butter of the new blood and everyone is supposed to jeer him. And it was just a really bad role reversal.
And there wasn't I think that you could build to Kidman wrestling Hogan eventually, but you have to build Kidman as a believable threat. And they have not done that.
Because Hogan came out and cut one of his best promos where, and this is the first time I ever remembered anybody saying the word push in a promo on Nitro when he says, "Yo, everybody wants to get their push." And he says something about being pee-whipped by his girlfriend. And I thought it was a really cool promo, even though it was a little bit of reality mixed with fiction.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, and also back to your original point, Ben, Bischoff is how you play a heel 100% as an authority figure. And I think that Russo, it felt like he was projecting too much and trying to, you know, hey, this is my chance to be a tough guy. And with Bischoff, it was all about trying to get over whoever he was. And I think Bischoff was always like that as a performer. You can say what you want about him as an executive, but as a performer.
He's very unselfish as a performer.
Extremely unselfish.
Yeah, always made other guys look good. I think we've covered a lot of ground, guys. I want to give a chance for some of the air to come back into the room. We have we've been talking up a storm, but this has been great. I think we're covering a lot of ground and we're giving some good opinions. When we come back on the other side of this break, with a lot of the background laid down, we're really going to dig into the meat of the show, talk about the U.S. title, talk about the world title, some of the other secondary titles, and also just some of the bigger questions. So you guys take a break, take a breather, go grab one of your favorite beverages. And for those of you listening, please sample some of the other great podcasts here on The Place to Be Nation. And we will be back with the second half of PTBN Main Event, Spring Stampede 2000.
I want to talk more about Man Cow.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show, right here on The Place to Be Nation. PlaceToBeNation.com, The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to The Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes at PlaceToBeNation.com. You can check out myself as Scott Criscolo on The Mothership, The Place to Be podcast, home of great interviews, our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews, and WWE Network live watches. If you need your fix of current wrestling talk, we have plenty of options for you, including The Main Event, featuring a roundtable discussion led by PTBN analysts and special guests, WrestleChat.net, Still Real to Us podcast with Jeff Peck, and Wrestling with Optimism, which focuses on what we should be excited about in the world of wrestling today. Also, be sure to relive wrestling's past with Graham Cawthon's excellent exclusive History of Wrestling podcast. Sports fans have plenty to dive into as well. We feature The Extra Point with Scott Criscolo and Dr. G, as well as the twice-weekly Bauer Show, The Kings of Sport, featuring live audio wrestling's godfather Nate Milton, The Sports Lounge, hosted by Cowboy and Cowboy Sr., often visited by special guests from inside the world of sports, as well as the NBA Team Podcast with Adam Murray and Andrew Reich for the deep dive into the world of pro hoops. As mentioned, all of these shows are available on PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. PTBN is also the home to tremendous in-depth features on pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, and more. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island and Fall River, Massachusetts, Scott Keats RSPWFAQ.com blog, and Piledriver.net for their support.
Chad, do you want your wrestling podcast to be informed by historical and analytical insight and by obsessive watching of footage from any era and any promotion and for them all to be available on one feed?
Sure do, Parv.
Chad, are you ready to shill?
I am, because I know you're talking about the Pro Wrestling Only Place to Be Nation Podcast Network.
Nothing. Let's go through that again. PWOPTBN Podcast Network.
Got it. That's where you can listen to all sorts of different shows covering the history of pro wrestling in detail.
Shows like Titans of Wrestling with my boys Pete, the man of a 10,000 discs, and Kelly, the jobber lover.
I'm a jobber.
The Pro Wrestling Super Show with Stephen Graham.
Join me, Stephen Graham.
The smash hit wrestling game show Brainbuster with
Johnny Sorrow.
We have a host of top contributors like wrestling historian Chris Zellner.
Hello, everyone. This is Chris Zellner here, starting a new podcast venture.
And the Pro Wrestling Only admins, the man who knows more about 90s wrestling than maybe anybody on earth, Charles, and good old Will from Texas.
This is Will, and I'm joined today by my good buddy Charles.
Whether it's the territories, WWF, NWA, Mid-South, Texas, Portland, tag team wrestling, Japanese wrestling, lucha, old school, new school, we got it.
And of course, the feed still has the mothership itself,
where the big boys play,
on which we continue our endless journey through WCW supercards.
PWO PTBN Podcast Network. It's pro wrestling only.
You know you want to hear it.
Welcome back to the second half of this month's episode of PTBN Rewind. My name is Ben Morris. We're covering WCW Spring Stampede 2000. I am joined by Greg Phillips and Andrew Reich. Guys, I hope you had a very productive break.
Spinneroonie!
Snoochie Moochie's Tony!
Mark Madden, the worst.
Oh, so bad. Why don't we talk about Mark Madden for a sec? Because it was one of those things I was like, if we have time, we'll get to it. But the announced team on this was Tony Schiavone, kind of the old WCW standby, Scott Hudson, one of the most underrated announcers in the history of the business, and Mark Madden, who everybody has an opinion on. And it sometimes seemed like the only purpose they had was to every 2 seconds remind us that the rules were relaxed and the referees were
let him fight it out.
We're not calling for disqualifications.
And also to occasionally curse.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. To be shocking. And,
when Tony said the word bullshit, I jumped out my chair for a second.
What'd you guys think of the announce team? Let's start with you, Greg.
It was interesting because, again, this is how 15 years of perspective changes things. When I was 16, I thought, again,
by the way,
maybe this
was
the idea.
Playing at home, if your drinking game is every time Greg mentions he was 16 when he watched it, take another shot.
I thought that Mark Madden was hilarious. I thought, oh, what a great change of pace. He's hip and he's relevant, and all these things that he's saying that I don't understand must be funny because he thinks they're funny.
Right.
Well, now going back and watching it again, he's horrible. He's just the worst. Like it's, and I actually think Schiavone and Scott Hudson, as you mentioned, very underrated. Scott Hudson is. I think they do the best that they can with what they've got, and they're really trying to still present it as a sport, as all these things are happening. And Mark Madden is there to undermine every single time that we have any kind of seriousness to any situation. He's there to say something that just beats you over the head with how phony it is.
Reese, you want to play contrarian and defend Mark Madden here?
That's funny. But no, Mark Madden I had already been a little familiar with because he was like one of the main voices for WCW.com. Whenever they did like an interview or they wanted to, or if they did some type of if he would pipe in on the hotline every now and then. And he had taken over for Bobby, I want to say around January.
Right.
And when Bobby Heenan stepped away, and you know, the main team for a long time was Tony and Heenan. And then it was Tony Hudson, who a lot of people thought was going to take over as the lead guy for Tony and when he was on vacation that one time in 1999. And so you got Tony and Hudson, who are both kind of lead guys. And then you've got Mark Madden, who's just this big sweltering pile of crap. And then there's Mike Tenay, who I think was relegated to lead play-by-play on Thunder.
Yeah, and he was doing backstage interviews and stuff. So, him and Zabisco were both on Thunder at this point.
Yes, so no Tanae on this show, which I think would have probably been a better option. But man, I mean, Mark Madden was so awful. He was like a poor man's Jerry Lawler at the time. You know, playing heel, you know, being a shill for the Chosen One. Pretty much anybody who was in support of Russo and Bischoff, he loved. Anyone who was not, he hated. He would contradict himself constantly. He was always looking for catchphrases that nobody cared about.
The Snoochie Roochies thing is awful.
Take Abbott, because I think Take Abbott beat the crap out of him on the intro before that.
How many times did he say DD me during the course of the show?
A lot of times. Plugging the book Positively Page. It was like, oh my God, please be quiet.
Yeah.
That's what a lot of people say when I talk to. But, yeah.
You're not the Mark Madden of this show. Really.
That's what I was about to say. Am I the Mark Madden of Place to Be?
No.
Of the Place to Be universe?
No. You're the Zabisco at worst. Greg,
Marshall.
Yeah. Greg, I feel like I cut you off when I unleashed the reach there. Did you have something else?
No, that was pretty much. I just wanted to say I actually appreciated I gained a lot of respect for Tony Schiavone and Scott Hudson for trying to keep this crashing train on the track as it was going throughout the course of the show. You know, they tried.
For Tony, it's really hard to play it straight, but he did his best.
Let's talk about the United States title tournament. We touched upon in the first half of the show how this was basically this was what held the show together. There was an 8-man U.S. title tournament. Sting was the sole Millionaires Club representative. And this was, interestingly enough, something we didn't talk about was the mission statement of the New Blood was to get rid of the Millionaires Club so that they could all fight each other on a level playing field, which I think was probably a little too above everyone's heads, the idea that that was their end goal and they were working together towards this greater good. And I don't think they really stuck to the script on that one. It's an interesting idea and concept, but this was one of the few times where we got to see it, because aside from whoever Sting was fighting, you got a lot of New Blood versus New Blood matchups here. And these were the matches that did take up the most time. Rather than go match by match, I kind of want to bullet point, lightning round style, talk about some of the guys in the tournament, both how they were played here, what their role was, how you think they were handled, and how far you think they could have gone. And we'll give, you know, both of you guys and myself a chance to talk about everyone. We'll try to go pretty quick. The first guy I want to talk about was The Wall, who in the first round of the tournament, and on Nitro, when everyone was attacking their counterparts, he put Sid through a table. But then Sid, whether it was injury or creative or whatever, ended up disappearing after that Nitro. So The Wall was kind of left without his counterpart to feud with. But on this show, he goes up against Scott Steiner in the first round of the U.S. title tournament and draws the sole disqualification of the show by accidentally, after getting irate by Steiner, he chokeslams one of the referees through a table, which still the rest of the night they go, so remember, you're not going to get disqualified unless you chokeslam a referee through a table. Now, to me, that kind of smacked up. Okay, The Wall, who throughout late 99 and early 2000 started out as Berlin's bodyguard.
Yes.
And then slowly being built into someone who clearly Sullivan and also Russo felt could be a top monster heel. So I felt like they were protecting him to a degree by not having him get pinned or submitted during the show. What did you think, Reach? Because The Wall never really amounts to what I think they wanted him to. What did you think as far as his ceiling?
Well, his ceiling wasn't high as a performer, but every time I think of The Wall, I get a smile on my face because
that's the Wall, brother.
Because that's what Greg is alluding to. One of the last Nitros before Russo and Bischoff came back in was a spring break show.
Yes.
Hogan was doing an interview with Mean Gene. He hears The Wall's music, and The Wall is on top of the hotel about 300 yards away, threatening to choke slam him from the top of the building. And Hogan infamously keeps saying, "That's The Wall, brother." And it's just, it makes no sense in context, but it's just one of the funniest, like, this is WCW kind of moments. Yeah, they would do something stupid like this. You know, rest in peace to the real life performer. I believe he's passed away. Am I correct?
He did pass away.
It's a shame, but as a performer, to be honest, he really wasn't much, you know, when they were building something for him, like when he was like looking like he was going to feud with Sid or with Kidman or with Hulk Hogan, and then it was kind of like, nope, you're back to the mid card again.
Yeah. Greg, any divergent thoughts here on the wall?
No. I joked earlier about how I love the wall, but I never liked him. That's one thing I vividly remember about this show is that I found it completely laughable that the wall got any offense on Scott Steiner. At this time, people don't understand how red hot Scott Steiner was at this time.
He had a brilliant promo where he faked his retirement due to back injury in January when he rejoined the NWO. And then he got suspended for saying comments about WCW management on the Nitro show. So he had come back into the fold when Russo showed up.
But he was red hot. He was this physical beast that was roided out of his mind, but like the most intimidating wrestler I had ever seen to that point. I thought he should have just suplexed the wall until he got tired, then put him in the Steiner recliner and ended it. So I never saw much in the wall, and I found him woefully inadequate when matched up with top tier talent. Again, though, rest in peace to the performer. Nothing against him, but as a performer, I never really saw much in him.
A guy who I think there was a lot more to and who came in a very unique way was Mike Awesome, who infamously debuted on the Nitro beforehand by attacking Kevin Nash. But the big deal was Mike Awesome at this time was still the ECW champion. He was in ECW, obviously either working without a contract or able to get out of his contract, but he showed up on Nitro well, still ECW champion. It was kind of the big splashy debut that I think Bischoff modeled this after when he had Lex Luger show up on the first Nitro. You know, have someone who was, there's no way he could have been there. Mike Awesome in ECW was ridiculous. This was a huge guy with legitimate power, but who could also fly, move like crazy. Not much of a talker, but he didn't need to be. He was that good in the ring. Comes in here. First match is supposed to go up against Ernest Miller, ends up going up against Bam Bam Bigelow, who takes Miller's spot. It's a bit convoluted. Basically, Awesome verbally punks out and then punks out Bigelow backstage, prompting Bigelow to get in there. So Awesome ends up taking out both Bigelow and Ernest Miller in the first round before having a
a match that started as Ernest Miller versus Mike Awesome becomes Mike Awesome versus Bam Bam, but Mike Awesome pins Ernest Miller because Ernest Miller comes back out because he's got to dance.
He's got to dance. Ernest Miller, things would get better for him as the new blood angle went on. But Awesome, you know, looked great in the first round, comes back in the second round, has a really physical match against Greg's boy, Scott Steiner, and then ends up losing there because Kevin Nash makes his sole appearance of the show, cracks him with a cast, or not a cast, with a crutch. They never really ended up blowing off their feud. They never fought on pay-per-view, which was interesting. I'm going to talk for a sec just about Mike Awesome. I thought had so much potential. There were so many good ways to use him. I didn't think putting him against Nash right off the bat was a great idea just because Awesome had kind of made his name in ECW, feuding with guys who were smaller than him and just looking like an animal. And I think you could have built to him going in there. I also, as I alluded to earlier, he would have been the perfect guy to feud with Hogan and just put a savage beating on Hogan. And they did actually wrestle, and it was actually a really good match.
Yeah, I think one time Awesome came in and was the muscle for Billy Kidd.
Basically, yeah. And I thought that was a great role for him. I thought Awesome had a great ceiling. He would not end up being used well in WCW at all, long term. It seemed like they had no idea what to do with him past bringing him in for an initial kind of surprise. I didn't love that, even though I know Nash interfered here, I didn't love that Awesome ended up submitting to the Steiner recliner. A pinfall, a fluke pin to keep him strong. To me, right off the bat with this show, they're already mishandling Mike Awesome, who could have been a big deal for them. So I don't know. What did you guys think of that? Greg, what did you think about Awesome and how he was handled early on and what could have been done with him?
I echo all of your thoughts. Mike Awesome in 2000 was one of my favorite wrestlers, like easily in my top 10 favorite wrestlers at the time, because of what he had done in ECW. And he was such a physical animal. And I think from the get-go, they didn't do a great job with him because they put him in there with Nash on the first Nitro, and it kind of exposed that Awesome wasn't as big as, you know, I thought he was, because he looked like a monster compared to everybody in ECW. And then when you get to Spring Stampede, I thought he was one of the MVPs of this show. I thought he was spectacular in the ring. He had a really bad promo, but He was not a promo guy. I think that the best use for him would have been as a heavy for somebody, but for whatever reason, Russo never really seemed to book characters like that, other than maybe Ken Shamrock, I guess. And that would have been the best role for Austin, would be to be a guy that didn't talk, came out and just beat the hell out of people in the ring. Cause he was, I thought he was spectacular on this show. His match with, even though it was short with Bigelow was hard hitting, and he showed incredible agility. I think he did a running dive over the guardrail. And then against Steiner, like you said, very good, short, hard hitting match with Steiner. Austin was tremendous, and I really have always hated that he never got to become a bigger star on a national level, because if they had just accentuated his strengths, which were anything that happens once the bell rings, and hit his weaknesses, which were promos, he would have been spectacular. But Russo just kept giving him weird gimmicks and trying to make him a comedy character, which never was the right role for him.
Yeah, and Senator, I think it speaks a lot, too, to the fact that even though he did end up having a good match with Bigelow, once again, ignoring what we just said, you know, they put him in there with Nash, who's a little bit taller than him, and then they put him in there against Bigelow, who he can't do half his moves against, because he's not going to powerbomb Bam Bam. He's not going to, you know, do any of his power moves on him. It did get a chance to showcase his flying, which was something no other big guy could do, but definitely they kind of handicapped him from the start. What'd you think, Rish?
You know, we just finished talking about The Wall, who's no longer with us, and, you know, here's another one who's no longer with us, and Mike Awesome. But, you know, to be cliche, Mike Awesome in this show was awesome. And in the ECW days, by this point, he was probably, I would say, in his physical prime, you know, having great matches with guys like Masato Tanaka and Spike Dudley, and really turning heads in ECW to the point that when he signed with WCW, a lot of people, you know, the internet fans, I guess you could call them, we're really looking forward to seeing what Awesome would do when he would get there. The problem was there was no Masato Tanaka in WCW, a guy who could go with reckless abandon at him, and just have a really fun, crazy, violent match. They would always feud him with guys like Sting, Jeff Jarrett. We mentioned Kevin Nash. The closest he had was Scott Steiner, and Steiner was more of a grounded wrestler than he was like a brawler.
Right.
So it wasn't really and the matches weren't going to be long as it was for this show. So it's not like you were going to get this like five-star classic as it was. But in terms of the performances individually, I thought like Greg was saying, I think he was like the MVP of the show. I thought he, in the two matches that he was involved with, he shined the brightest among most of the performers just in terms of his own performance.
Yeah, and I think, you know what, you touched on another thing there, Andrew, is that with him as part of the New Blood feuding with the Millionaires Club, there was no one on the Millionaires Club, even the best guys in the ring, DDP and Sting, he was not going to get to do the things to them that got him over in ECW. He was not going to get to powerbomb them through tables off the apron. You know, that was not going to happen. So, you know, maybe Mike Awesome was doomed from the start. I still think they could have done something with him. Be remiss if I did not mention the awesome, no pun intended, fanny pack that he wore when he debuted on Nitro. He was truly a wrestler's wrestler.
Yep.
Oh,
yep.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. He had a fanny pack on when he destroyed
the fanny pack mullet combo. Was quite mocked back in the day online, but I loved it.
He looked like every bit a professional wrestler with a mullet and a fanny pack. Come on.
And what incredible agility that he had, too.
Yeah, that he was talking about the dive over the railing. That was impressive.
That was incredible. All right, another guy we want to talk about, someone that Greg was heaping praise on before and deservedly so, that's Booker T, who only has a quick in-ring role. Well, not even that quick. He wrestles Sting in the first round, but they actually have a decent long little match. Very competitive. Booker, a natural babyface at this point, and they realized this quickly enough, and he's already kind of programmed as a babyface here. He loses to Sting, but then, you know, shakes his hand after, I guess pounds him or whatever, gives him the fist pound, gives him daps, as the kids say.
As the kids call it.
And then gets chewed out backstage by Russo for, you know, why are you showing respect? And then later shows up again as like Russo's muscle in another scene. It was very weird. But to their credit, they did seem to realize they had something with Booker T. And this is something I wanted to see, and they needed to, because there were only so many guys in the Millionaires Club, and there were dozens of guys in the New Blood, so they needed to cross some of the more natural baby faces over to being at least sympathetic to the Millionaires Club. Reach, do you think they could have, right off the bat on the first Nitro, sided Booker with the Millionaires Club, or was it a better move to kind of slow burn, as slowly as Russo does anything, move him over to the babyface side of the ledger?
Well, first of all, I want to mention that at this point, Booker T was only Booker.
Oh, right, because
he had lost his T to Big T for Halloween 2000. So he
God, I'd forgotten about that, dude.
So he was only billed at this time as Booker.
I think they called him Booker T accidentally a few times on the show. But
yeah, they. I would almost bet they said it a couple of times as like verbal slippage. But with when you're talking about, you know, him being aligned with the Millionaires Club and him saying, you know, and I thought his promo was like one of the best ones where it was kind of classy with Mean Gene. It was kind of straightforward. Like, I'm not all for the new blood. I'm just trying to make my own way. What I think the mistake they made was that they wanted to make such a big splash with that first Nitro on that first segment that they sort of kind of aligned all the young guns together, whereas, you know, they should have done what they did with Scott Steiner in a way, where Steiner was like, man, I don't give a fuck about the new blood. I'm just a crazy dude trying to do crazy things. And with Booker T, it should have been kind of in the same way. Like, I'm not all for the new blood and all this. I'm just trying to make my way and trying to move up the card. And I wish they'd have done it that way. They had all these detours where he joined a group that we're not going to talk about because they didn't debut yet, called the Misfits in Action. And his name was G.I. Bro. And then he goes back to Booker T and he wins the WCW title in this crazy happenstance when Hogan used his creative control and all. And, oh, I don't want to talk about that.
It's a lot. It's a big can of worms open right now.
But
let's just suffice to say things worked out okay for Booker.
Yeah, and the match itself with Sting is really good.
Yeah, like, agreed.
Yep.
You know, it's about 10 to 8 minutes, but you know, Sting and Booker had wrestled each other for a really long time in WCW, all the way back to like the early 90s. So they're really familiar with one another, and I know I'm going to give Greg this olive branch because I thought Sting performance-wise and physique-wise was in a really good place.
Yeah.
Agreed. We'll get to him in a minute, though, but I want to piggyback off what you said about Booker. At this point, like, one of the things watching this show did was reminded me of, as great as he was in WWE as a performer, he was outstanding. His character was great and everything like that. In ring, he was probably at the peak of his abilities at this point. Like, between 98 and 2001, the injuries weren't there. It's a pleasure to watch him work. Watching that Sting match, how fluid he is, how everything that he does just looks like poetry in motion with, you know, not the Jeff Hardy move, but the actual term. And he was just incredible. He flies through the air with ease. He puts together his matches logically. Never had a bad match at that time. That was the other thing that people always loved about Booker at that time in WCW. I always told this to people at the time, is that even if the show sucked, you knew you were going to get a good match out of Booker T. Every single time. It might not be great, but it would at least be good. And I agree. I thought the match was really strong. I thought his promo was really strong. I always admired that WCW, for the most part, after Harlem Heat broke up and he went up on his own, they let Booker T be a – and this is something Russo deserves a lot of credit for, I think. They presented Booker T as just a really classy wrestler. It wasn't a stereotype. They didn't – you know, it was him. It was just a guy who was a world champion wrestler, and he was outstanding.
My nerdy nitpick is that Booker plays heel in the match, which I think would have been better if they were both kind of baby faces.
That actually brings up an interesting point. What did you guys think about in this U.S. title tournament? Why did they bracket them the way they did? Because you get two heels wrestling in Scott Steiner and Mike Awesome. You get two faces wrestling in Sting and Booker T. That's kind of weird bracketing, it feels like.
I think it was because they wanted to do the end of match thing with Sting and Booker, because they wanted to start immediately building on the fact that, you know, Booker has this character where he respects the Millionaires Club guys. He's not really part of the new blood. If he had just lost to Steiner, there would have been zero progression for him. So I think it was a necessary, even though him and Sting were the two clear baby faces in the tournament, they needed him to wrestle the other babyface because that's the only way to do his character progression, I think.
Yeah, and do the respect angle, to which Mark Madden responds, that sucks.
Yeah, which is great.
What an ass.
Classic Madden. let's talk about Sting. Let's talk about – we've already touched on the fact that he was basically the workhorse of the Millionaires Club. We'll give DDP some credit as well. But Sting, you know, the workhorse of the Millionaires Club, looked great on the show, did seem like he was newly motivated, and Sting – I've talked about it across many shows, you know, utmost respect for the guy. I think all three of us are big Sting fans, but, you know, definitely in a better place where he's motivated, where he's a guy who actually, when he has younger opponents to work against, and I think we saw this all the way up to TNA, he will try to raise his game as he gets here. He is already in, to me, one of the hottest feuds of the New Blood Millionaires Club program with Vampiro. Because Vampiro had been built as having a relationship with Sting. That was one of the bright spots, actually, I think, of the Sullivan era, was Vampiro's rise as a babyface and his relationship with Sting. They were both super over. That tag team was super over. But Vampiro was a natural heel. He was a guy who just was great, creepy, sinister. And this feud with Sting, probably something that was going to happen whether Russo and Bischoff came back or not. My only knock here is that they end up wrestling each other in the semifinals because Vampiro beats Kidman in the first round thanks to Hogan. Sting beats Booker T. They meet up here, not in the finals. And then Sting beats him clean, which to me, I get it. You can have Vampiro come back and do something more dastardly, which he does in the finals. But to me, it always felt weird, and it always kind of cut the legs out from under Vampiro. I'm curious what you guys think. Greg, what did you think? You know, we can talk a little bit about Sting. I think we've covered him a lot, though. But as far as giving away Sting versus Vampiro in their first match here in the middle of the show where you knew it wasn't going to get more than 5 minutes, and then not only that, having Vampiro go under clean.
I guess, first off, I'll just say I'm a huge Sting fan, and I agree that he was newly motivated at this time. Really, ever since he came back in early 99, he was in so much better shape. He was in a better place mentally and physically, and he really got on a really good run of great matches throughout 99. And then coming back for this, I think he thought it would be a really, you know, a lifeblood shot for WCW, coming back and having this feud with Vampiro. He looked great on the show. I thought he had the best matches on the show, was flying around, was bumping around, and really, and was, in my opinion, was the most over guy on the show, was the most popular with that particular crowd. But as for the Vampiro thing, I agree. Big mistake to give that away right out of the gate. It was classic kind of, and I don't mean to harp on the guy, he did a lot of good things too, but classic Vince Russo, basically spamming the audience with a matchup, because we would see Sting and Vampiro wrestle each other seemingly 1,000 times for the next few months. And what was a cool feud got overexposed really quickly. And I think giving away that match so early on, and even though it did give Vampiro motivation for what he did later, just kind of a mistake, in my opinion. They could have kept them separate and had the impetus for the feud be the coming through the mat and pulling Sting to the depths of hell, or whatever that was supposed to be. So yeah, I definitely agree with you, Ben. It could have been more than it was. They could have stretched it out a little bit, but it was one of the highlights of the New Blood era, was definitely Vampiro and Sting. They had because Sting was a character that was always over with every fan base, every crowd they went to, it made it easy to work feuds with him. It was just a matter of finding the right guy, and Vampiro was the right guy to have a feud with him at that time.
Yeah, I guess another part of the problem with this U.S. title tournament and sticking all these New Blood guys in there, aside from, you know, the Ernest Millers of the world, was they needed to job a lot of these guys, and you ended up having guys like Mike Awesome, guys like Vampiro, Booker to a lesser extent, not necessarily looking, you know, too weak, but they did get sacrificed to the greater goal of getting to the finals, which ended up being Sting and Steiner. Andrew, let's get your thoughts on, you know, any of the stuff we just touched on with Sting and Vampiro, but also the structure of the U.S. title tournament. Is there a way they could have done it better, or do you think they handled it fine?
Well, they definitely could have handled the structure of the tournament better.
What would you have done?
Well, I would have probably just had Billy Kidman wrestle Scott Steiner, which would have been a little bit of a better, you know, off and on there, and have Vampiro wrestle against somebody like a Booker T, if you could do it that way. And you could have mixed it up a little differently, in which you would have had more of the New Blood guys wrestle some more of the veterans. You don't necessarily have to get away from New Blood versus New Blood. That's okay. But I think the way that they did it is that they wanted to book it so that, you know, Scott Steiner would kind of skate by into the finals because of other outside interference things. And you know, he was sort of untouchable. And I, you know, I think they used the wrong opponents to do that. I think they could have used the wall better on the other side. You could have had, you could
have be the guy who submits rather than Michael.
Yeah. And yes. I remember they had a feud between Vampiro and the wall. So right. I think that could have made sense in some really weird way too. About Vampiro and Sting is, it's obvious, I agree with Greg, it's obvious lack of logic by Russo, but the reason I think he did it is because unlike Hogan and Kidman and, you know, Russo and Flair, and then the later ones that we saw, like Lex Luger and Chuck Palumbo, I'm trying to think of the other ones, that Shane Douglas and Ric Flair and DDP and Jeff Jarrett, the one between Sting and Vampiro had already been kind of interlinked already because they were the quote-unquote brothers in paint.
Yeah, this was going to happen regardless. Like
so they were teasing it as it was, and Vince Russo just decided, okay, we're going to blow this off now. Having him go down clean against Sting in a match that only lasted about 5 minutes in an innocuous tournament was stupid. But, you know, having them wrestle over and over again, I didn't hate it as much as Greg did, but I think that they could have definitely held off early on by building it more. Like, have Vampiro's only appearance be him coming out under the ring. That would have been more of a surprise.
Yeah.
You know, and so
and they definitely, like, you didn't have guys you couldn't have used there because, as we saw from the open on Nitro, there were a million guys in the New Blood.
Including Brian Knobbs.
Right. He's the one who jumps out to me just because he had that weird, like, yellow,
and
like,
Van
silk
Hammer.
Shirt. Van Hammer, all these guys. You could have used this as, you know, I remember that all the guys who ended up being Misfits in Action were just kind of put there because they were losers. You could have had Van Hammer and Chavo and all these guys losing in the U.S. title tournament and had Vampiro just show up to interfere, had Mike Awesome just run in and go crazy.
No,
you know?
You needed to rely on those guys for that epic cruiserweight title, whatever match
there.
That was.
We'll get there. None of them were in the cruiserweight title match. Just Lash LaRue.
Oh, Lord.
We'll get there.
Don't you make fun of Lash LaRue, Mr. Riche.
Riche can't.
They're he's neighbors. From Lafayette. I hate that guy.
Yeah, they're neighbors. Lash LaRue's renting a room from Riche right now.
He stole three Vicodins out of my bathroom cabinet just about an hour ago.
All right, so let's wrap up this U.S. title tournament with, we've kind of alluded to it, but the way it ends is Scott Steiner beating Sting with the help of Vampiro, who comes out through the ring. And drags Sting to the depths of hell, or, you know, the floor of the Allstate Arena. And Sting reemerges. It was weird. He had, like, they were still reluctant to say blood. They would not say blood. They just said, you know, he has a red liquid on his face, which, come on, guys. Which looked weird because Sting still had the face paint on, so it kind of just looked
Sting,
like he got some
maybe
red
Sting. Paint. Maybe Sting was on a maple syrup binge.
I don't know, man. It looked like he rejoined the Wolf. We thought about rejoining the Wolf Pack while he was under the ring, and then
and then decided, thought better of it.
Yeah, decided against it. But anyways, long story short, Scott Steiner puts him in the Steiner recliner, wins, gets the U.S. title. Greg, you've been talking Scott Steiner up all night, and I like the fact that, as Andrew alluded to, he gives a promo where he basically says, he's like, I'm not doing this for the New Blood. I'm doing this because I'm crazy and I want to win the U.S. title. Was he the guy here? Was he the right choice to make U.S. champion? It's kind of a slam dunk because I think he was, but, you know, let's talk about it for a sec.
Yes. Yes, he was. He was the right guy. And I have to say this real quick. As awesome as Scott Steiner was at this time, the Steiner recliner was not awesome.
Oh, terrible.
It's just
terrible.
It was like heat killer. It was a momentum killer.
It was like the worst John Cena STF multiplied by 100. Mm-hmm. Just horrible. And I remember thinking, just put the guy in a regular camel clutch. But
yeah.
But that being said, yeah, Steiner was the right choice. He was a heat magnet. I mean, to the point that there were shows in the latter part of 1999, the early part of 2000, where I legitimately was afraid that Scott Steiner was going to pull fans over the guardrail.
And, oh, my God, sure. Yeah. He would have those fan interactions where I was like, this is going to get bad.
It was incredible, and he was a heat magnet. He needed the title. He was fresh. The character was fresh and new, and really he was the only character other than maybe Sting in WCW at that time that felt like he could have transitioned to the WWF naturally. He felt like a WWF character to me.
Let me put this out to you, Riche, and then Greg, if you want to touch upon it as well, go for it as well. As over as Steiner was, and as integral to the New Blood as he was. Was he above the U.S. title? Should he have been in the world title picture right away? Or is this one of those cases where, you know, we've talked about it before, sometimes it's good to have guys run a little while with the secondary title to get them ready for the main event?
The reason why I think, first of all, to answer your question, I think he was definitely in that spot where if you want to put him, put the world title on him, that would have, I would have completely accepted. I mean, Sid Vicious had held the belt for 4 months. Mm-hmm. So
it would have been interesting to also have kind of like a wild card as the champ.
Yeah.
Some guy who's not,
but
who's
that
not
was,
allied with the New Blood or the Millionaires Club, although maybe it's something you do in a couple months. I'm getting ahead of myself.
But that was the dilemma. The dilemma was that Steiner was so volatile, not only in the ring and with his promos, but backstage, that you just didn't – because he even got – I think people don't remember this, but he actually got suspended again right before Bash at the Beach, and they stripped him of the U.S. belt. So, you know, he was just so unpredictable. But like Greg was saying, it was like – the thing I did like about Russo coming in again is that you had this kind of like caged beast, and then they finally told Scott Steiner, okay, let's open the cage and just let this beast go, like, go wreak havoc. And I thought that Steiner, although not every segment hit home, I thought he was motivated. I thought his matches were decent, and the character was just so wild and so, so in your face, that I think that it really would have worked with him as the world champion instead of Jeff Jarrett. The problem was they booked themselves, like you like to always say, booked themselves into a corner because Jeff Jarrett was the quote-unquote chosen one, and they wanted to pay off that storyline.
Yeah, I do love saying that. I should get shirts made. Greg, what do you think about world champion Scott Steiner? Was it too soon?
You know, maybe it was too soon at that time, but then again, I remember that the year before at Spring Stampede 99, I believe he also won the U.S. title, or at least
he won
the
another
US
tournament. No, he won another
he
tournament.
He lost the TV belt and then won the U.S. tournament.
So it kind of feels like they were kind of he was back in the same spot. So maybe it was the right time to push him as the world champion. At the time, I liked Jeff Jarrett a lot too, but looking back on it, I think that Steiner was a more world champion level character because he was, as I mentioned earlier, he was so different. He was the one character they had that felt, to me anyway, like a WWF character because he was so out there and so unhinged and so just entertaining. Whether he was flubbing his lines like Simpy or whatever, or whether he was cutting a classic promo, it was entertaining. Everything he did was entertaining. There was nothing boring about him. So I think that it may have been the right time to put him in the role instead of Jeff as the world champion at that point. However, as Andrew pointed out, there was the volatility issue, and Jarrett was very reliable. You didn't have to worry about him blowing up backstage. So, you know, there's probably something to that as well, but I definitely wouldn't have had any issue swallowing him as a world heavyweight champion at that time.
I do think looking long term, there would have been something really interesting too if Jarrett gets the belt initially for the New Blood and, you know, rather than what they'd end up doing, which was just 18 world title changes the next 2 months, they built to Steiner getting it and then it starting to become a three-way war rather than a two-way war. You know, they weren't able to book this long term because things fell apart quickly, but there would have been something interesting there. You never know. I think maybe I don't know if he was necessarily the guy here for what they were trying to achieve, but maybe sooner than he got it.
And think about the licensing revenue they would have gotten for all those chainmail headdresses they could have sold.
Oh, if only they had acted sooner. Yeah. By the time they did, it was too
late. I will say I don't like the fact that WWE dubbed the police siren music, which I thought was ahead of its time, with
Steiner Eyes.
Yeah, Steiner Eyes. Like, they're really... I watch it, it's like, dude.
It was weird.
The whole show, almost everyone's theme music is overdubbed.
Including Iron Man by Black Sabbath for Russo.
Yeah, we're talking about the WWE Network version, which you guys were right. It was really weird that Scott Steiner was coming out to his old school Steiner Brothers 1996.
Comes out very like odd. Sting does this energetic entrance, which was originally to the Metallica song "Seek and Destroy," and he comes out and he said they're playing his slow organ music.
Yep. They should have just thrown "Man Called Sting" on there.
I know. That actually would have fit for a change, but it was a weird how just hearing all DDP's was the weirdest to me though.
Yeah. Jeff Jarrett had a weird one too, but we're going to get to both of those guys in a sec. Before we do, we're not going to take too long to get there because there were two other titles on this show that were not really focal points, but they're in there. And even the announcers forget about them pretty frequently. But and so I don't feel that bad lumping them together. and kind of trying to cover a lot of ground pretty quickly here. You had the hardcore title, which going into the show was held by Brian Knobbs, gets vacated and ends up being Terry Funk, who, as the announcers, this was actually something I enjoyed the announcers doing, was them talking about how Terry Funk was clearly not a member of the New Blood, but was not a member of the Millionaires Club either. I liked Madden continually saying, you know, he doesn't have $1 million because he spent it all on moonshine and stuff like that. So that was kind of fun. Him going against Norman Smiley, who was a New Blood guy, and Terry Funk ends up winning the hardcore title due to the actions of Dustin Rhodes, who's also kind of unaligned, who then gets fired in a backstage skit by Vince Russo and is not seen again for a year. But that's one bit. And Terry Funk and Norman Smiley just have this crazy backstage brawl. It was the type of thing that both guys were. It was kind of perversely entertaining.
Just can I pipe in and
– Yeah, no, jump in on this stuff.
Can I pipe in and just admit freely I actually enjoyed this match?
Oh, I
did too. Screaming Norman Smiley is an underrated
gimmick. When he's looking
gimmick.
For Norman in the bathroom and Norman
and you just hear him screaming.
It's just really funny. He's in the Chicago Cubs gear because he's in they're in Chicago obviously for the show. You know, just crazy stuff where there's like that, you know, they like waste all this like amounts of Coca-Cola when they're trying like fighting into the kitchen and the drink machine and
oh yeah, they killed their budget on these
hits them in the head with a laptop. And let me tell you, I had a laptop computer in 2000. That shit hurt.
It wasn't cheap.
And it wasn't cheap.
And,
yeah,
and it hurt.
Yeah.
No,
a ladder from the ring onto Norman Smiley, which I had to hurt a little bit.
I think there's no shame in enjoying this match. In the middle of what was this crazy, you know, everything's high stakes, everyone wants to kill each other, you know, these are mortal enemies. Just this kind of goofy, fun Terry Funk just beating the piss out of Norman Smiley with, like, you know, bags of popcorn and stuff. No, this was great. I thought it was a really good time.
And when he hangs on the pipe and he's hitting him with a chair like a cat.
Yeah, it was great. It was
and
great.
Also, Tony Schiavone is underrated at calling wild, crazy type fights. You know,
the only thing this was missing was Dusty Rhodes on commentary.
Oh yeah, there's a screamer in the men's room.
He would have had a blast.
He threw a ladder on him, Tony.
Yeah, he would have had a blast with this.
But one nitpick thing that bothered me about not the match but the. I guess the angle surrounding the match was, you know, Dustin comes out, attacks Funk, it backfires, Funk wins. Russo's pissed at Dustin and fires him. Russo's promo just like grated my. It was another example of him not really doing a good job of playing an actual heel, and that he's firing Dustin, and he says, if I'm trying to remember the exact verbiage, I believe he said that, who was it that created the best character you ever had? Who was it that put every word in your mouth? And I'm like, okay, you just killed pro wrestling. So Goldust, all those promos were scripted by some other guy, which leads you to believe that every other character's promos are scripted by some other guy, which leads you to believe that the whole thing's phony, and why should we believe anything that we're seeing?
Yeah, Russo went out of his way in all his backstage stuff to kind of bury guys, which wasn't great. He did it earlier with the Mamalukes and the Harris Boys, and in a less
– Yeah, but they deserve to be buried.
Well, all right. But at the same time, you know, just basically being like, four guys, you can't beat two at once. But yeah, we won't loop back to that. We talked enough about Russo's shortcomings as a heel character. The other title match was a Suicide Six-Way, oddly named. It was just a six-way match. For the Cruiserweight title, you had Shannon Moore, the Artist, formerly known as Prince Iaukea, Andrew's buddy Lash LaRue, Hard Knocks, Chris Candido. I never understood why his nickname was Hard Knocks, but go for it. Juventud Guerrera and the Maniacal Crowbar, as Tony calls him. I'm going to start this off saying that I was an unabashed fan of Three Count, and I think demonstrated before the match, like, nobody got heat like Three Count. Even in the midst of the show where you had all these main event headline, future of the company guys, I swear to God, Three Count drew heat like nobody's business, and they were great at it.
Now, there were only two guys here. I think it was Shannon Moore and Shane Helms. Who was the third one?
Evan Courageous.
It was Evan Courageous. Okay, I could never remember.
Yeah.
I don't know if they were just really good plants in the crowd, but the girls loved Three Count.
The shot of that – I don't know if it was a plant either. I suspect it probably was, but the shot of that girl in the audience who
– Oh, they were into
She looked like she was one of those girls that you show in the Ed Sullivan Show when the Beatles first appeared.
Well, Backstreet Boys and NSYNC was a huge thing. I mean, they were selling out stadiums and domes, you know, at this time. So, you know, even like the inkling of a boy band in any arena would get the, you know, would get the girls, sure, you know, screeching. And the other thing I noticed with the girls in the crowd, the midriff was like a big thing in 2000. I don't understand why, but I don't miss it.
So as far as this match itself, it's an okay match. It's a bunch of spots. I think it was kind of yet another attempt to resurrect the cruiserweight division, which really had its heyday from about 96 to 98. And then the minute Kidman dropped the title, things started going downhill. What did you guys think? And I'll just throw the finish in there real quick, is that Candido wins with the help of a debuting Tammy, formerly known as Sunny, which they make sure to get right in there. Tammy Sitch debuts. I guess she's just Tammy here. She helps Candido win. He was an odd choice for cruiserweight title, but I think they just wanted to get a belt on him. What did you guys think of the match? What did you think of the result? Did you think Tammy was going to be able to have any sort of impact in 2000? She didn't end up having much. What did you think of Candido as champion? Greg, let's go to you first.
This match as a whole was very weird. I definitely agree. Chris Candido was a weird choice. He was a good wrestler. He was always a good wrestler, but I never saw him as a cruiserweight. And maybe it's because he was in the WWF for so long and they didn't have a cruiserweight division. Right. But he just never screamed cruiserweight to me. Thought Hoovy, you know, Hoovy was obviously the quintessential cruiserweight at that point, but I don't know what was going on with him and, you know, real life or whatever. I thought he was the best character in the match and the most over guy. Probably would have won on that basis anyway. Crowbar, I liked as a wrestler a lot, and I liked him at that time as a character, but the maniacal Crowbar, I'm sorry. Yeah. And going back and watching it, there's this one point in the match where he just randomly just takes a flat back bump for no reason, just does it.
Yeah.
And I was like, maybe at the time it was funny, but now I'm just like, wow, that really disrupted any momentum the match had. But yeah, overall, it was not a very good match. A bunch of lame duck characters, and as for Tammy, I did think she could make an impact at that time. I was a big fan of hers and thought that she could come in and, you know, cut believable promos, get some heat generated onto Candido because he never really had much of a personality. So I thought it could be useful at that time. I was wrong, obviously, but I was wrong about a lot of things I thought at the time about this show.
I will jump on that, Craig, and kind of disagree with you. Candido, especially as I've gone back and watched some of the ECW stuff on the network, I think Candido was a criminally underappreciated talent, not just in the ring, but if you listen to his promos in ECW, and you know what, spade a spade, I don't know how much of this was him and how much was the chemicals he was on, but he was hilarious. He was all over the place, and he was a good promo when they let him loose. I don't think he ever talked when he was in WCW, or he barely talked. I think Candido is one of the biggest tragedies to me in wrestling. And there's some, you know, obviously incredible tragedies in terms of guys who have died, guys who have been crippled, all this other stuff. The thing with Chris Candido to me is he was so talented and he never got a shake for all those years that he was talented. Finally cleaned himself up. And this is, you know, going to be on this show. Finally cleaned himself up. Seemed like he could have been something, and then died from something that had nothing to do with all the demons he fought.
Yep.
Chris Candido's always been an exceptionally sad story for me. But that's neither here nor there. Rish, what were your thoughts on some of the stuff Greg touched on and just surrounding this match in general?
Russo never liked the cruiserweights. The moment he got there, he hated the luchadors and put him in a pinata on a pole match just to get him out of there.
This match was very much Bischoff against Russo, and that Bischoff was always a big proponent of the cruiserweights, and Russo...
He was, and Sullivan wasn't a proponent of the cruiserweights either. So it was weird because the cruiserweights weren't really getting that much of a push when Russo was ousted. So we didn't really see any cruiserweights if it didn't involve either the Filthy Animals or Three Count. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was kind of just like, let's just throw all these people in and just have this worthless match. And it really was. The only things I can say about it is that Candido is the champion, while lacks a little logic because he was more of like a lighter heavyweight. It was still better off than having Oklahoma wrestle Dusa for the cruiserweight title like we did in like January at the beginning of the year. And the other thing is that I don't know if it's just me as a guilty pleasure, but Juventud Guerrero was the color guy on Thunder. And if anybody can track those tapes down or
tremendous.
YouTube, please find them for me because
yeah, tremendous. I do remember that.
He would call him. He was trying to do The Rock, and he would because The Rock had made fun of him on Raw, and he called himself the Juice.
Yeah,
and it was just really that's just a random thought about the cruiserweights at the time. There were just no cruiserweights there; they were all gone.
Yeah, so not a lot to say about the cruiserweights. I think we're pretty safe moving on here, and that brings us to the final match of the evening, which was interesting in the sense that by the time we got there, you know, so much of the exciting stuff we talked about with Flair, with Russo, with Kidman, with Hogan, with the U.S. title tournament, with Steiner, with Sting, with Vampiro. By the time we got to what was supposed to be the biggest match of the night, I don't know about you guys, but I was kind of like, you know what, this feels a little anticlimactic, just in terms of who we had. What we had was, for the world title, as we said, Jeff Jarrett was the centerpiece of the New Blood. He was the chosen one. He was the guy who was going to get put into the world title match no matter what. I think he had like a weird semi-qualifying match on Nitro where he beat Kurt Hennig. I don't know. Was that first Nitro, Andrew, where Sean Stasiak came out and interfered?
I think that may have been Thunder.
At some point, Jeff Jarrett beat Kurt Hennig.
Yeah, because Sean Stasiak was perfect. Kurt Hennig's counter. He was perfect. Perfect Sean. Yeah. I can't remember. I didn't watch the Thunder show leading into this review, so I can't really say for sure. But yeah, he definitely wrestled in a match.
So you had that, and then you had DDP being the guy to basically, I think we all had a sense that whoever was in this match was going to put over Jeff Jarrett. Because Jeff Jarrett, say what you will about him, in the early part of 2000, he was one of the diamonds in the rough as far as WCW.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah.
He was the guy who was great as a heel, putting on good matches. Basically, when everyone was injured, because all the Millionaires Club guys were out with injuries, Goldberg was injured, Bret Hart ended up having to retire. Jeff Jarrett was the guy who would step up and basically do everything. There was a rumor for a while that he didn't want to become world champion. I forget why. It was a lot to do with, you know, basically I don't think he saw – he didn't want to be on top of what he thought was kind of a dying company because he came in with Russo, and then when Russo got ousted, he was a bit directionless. Russo comes back, and now they're ready to hand the ball to Jarrett. DDP as the guy who's going to make Jarrett here. What did you guys think of that? Of all the guys they could have picked, I mean, I think some of it was process of elimination, that everyone else in the Millionaires Club had a logical feud. I mean, you could have put Sting in here, but at the same time, he already had a ready-made feud with Vampiro. Everyone else kind of had their other guy. DDP was, you know, still a decent worker. He was hurting from a back injury, but aside from Sting, I would say he was probably the best worker of the bunch. Greg, what did you think about DDP as the guy to kind of help Jeff Jarrett get to that next level?
I like it. DDP was, as you mentioned, a very good worker, and, you know, always one of those always reliable guys. And I think what I said earlier about Booker T applies to Jeff Jarrett at this time as well. Mr. Consistency for WCW at that point. Anytime he was on the card, you knew you were going to get a maybe not a great match, but at least a good match. And he was going to cut a decent promo and he was going to be over. And DDP was always over. But I think the issue here, I recently, for reasons that elude me, went back and watched Sold Out 2000. And DDP had been a heel for the entirety of 99 and into the early part of 2000. And so I thought that that lost a little bit of the buzz from the match. And I actually do think that they could have put Sting in there and had Vampiro interfere and cost Sting the match against Jarrett. And that might have worked better for that live crowd. Because I thought the crowd came off a little soft at times in the main event. But that being said, other than that, other than Sting, DDP was the best worker in the Millionaires Club. He was the right guy. He knew how to cut promos, which is huge. He could cut heel or face promos, and they were able to involve Kimberly, which I think was a big drawing point for Russo, and for every male at the time in the audience. So
Kimberly was great.
Oh my God! Yeah,
it was incredible. I forget how great Kimberly looked. I don't know how I forgot. Blocked it out somehow. But you know, it's interesting you say possibly putting Sting there because, you know, the point there is probably, you know, you put DDP in the U.S. title tournament where he probably could have done, you know, a good job, could have wrestled a few good matches. You throw Sting in here. I think what you just alluded to, Greg, is the reason it wasn't was that the way this match ends is with Kimberly, who was married to DDP in real life and who had been taken out on Monday with a guitar shot by Jarrett. The end comes where Bischoff comes down and distracts the referee, which he didn't really need to do because, hey, guys, the rules are relaxed. You know, they're not calling disqualifications, but for some reason he does. Kimberly gets in the ring with the guitar rather than hitting Jarrett. Boom. Nails DDP with the guitar, gives Jarrett the pinfall. It was about as Russo an ending as you're going to get.
What a swerve.
Yeah, with Bischoff looking at the camera and going, wow, I think.
Yeah. It was very much Russo's, we can't just have an ending, we got to have a swerve ending. So I think that's why it had to be DDP instead of Vampiro. Andrew, what'd you think, man? Did the swerve hurt this? Was it too predictable? I remember even watching at the time in high school. I was like, well, you know, I know Vince Russo. I'm not even that smart at this point, but I know Vince Russo well enough to know that if DDP's wife got hit with a guitar, he is going to hit her, or she is going to hit him with a guitar.
Exactly.
It's the anti-swerve. We are expecting it.
It would have been a swerve if she had actually hit Jared with the guitar.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, there's a couple of things I liked about Kimberly. if you watch the 40-year-old virgin, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But you know, they had already kind of teased that they might have been like going their separate ways anyway, because he had feuded with Buff Bagwell.
Yeah, I remember that.
And there had floated out a rumor that Bagwell was sleeping with Kimberly. And then they turned that into some kind of real life-ish type of feud on television, and it linked Kimberly and DDP back together because they broke up the Nitro Girls. So it was kind of you're asking me if they telegraphed the heel turn? Absolutely. You know, I mean, Kimberly as like a slutty heel was so awesome. I thought she really sold it great in the later months. You know, the one thing I really want to hit on, though, with the match is two things. And one is kind of a question I want y'all both to ponder. First of all, Diamond Dallas Page in a main event match always delivered. Even in the worst of the worst shows, if you gave him an opportunity to really show something in a 15 or 17 minute window, he was going to provide some kind of guaranteed quality. And Spring Stampede is kind of his show because that's where he broke out and beat Savage in 97. Sure. He won the title in 1999. So for him to be able to be the star of this show again on Spring Stampede was pretty cool because historically, what's that?
He was Mr. Spring Stampede.
He was Mr. Spring Stampede.
They should do a 3-disc DVD set.
All five of his matches on Spring Stampede. The other thing is, and I want to ask both of y'all the question, if Jeff Jarrett is not the guy that gets pushed here, and say it's Steiner or Kidman or, hell, The Wall, but if Jeff Jarrett doesn't get that push to the world title, does he get the credibility that he was needing in order to run and be the head character at TNA in the later years? Like, would they have bought into it as much?
Probably not.
Yeah. No, I don't think so. I think it was – the thing was, Andrew, I think he was in many ways at this point the uncrowned champion, even going back to the Sullivan days. I think everyone thought it was just a matter of time because he was just so consistent and so over and felt like a star. He never had the world title. So it's hard to even answer that question because to me, even before he had the belt, he was already kind of the world champion and it was just inevitable.
Yeah.
But yeah, if he hadn't had this run, I don't know what would have happened to him.
TNA may never happened.
It's true. Well, I think it would have happened because I think him and Jerry Jarrett were determined to do what they were going to do with that, regardless. But I do think, do they have their main event guy? It would have been weird if the first world title Jeff Jarrett ever won was in TNA. Mm-hmm. I agree with you on that point. Like, it's definitely an interesting thing.
But the match itself, despite the crazy finish and the garbage, it's a WWF-ish type of 1999 match style where they high action to start, brawl on the rampway in the first 5 minutes, and then they do like the two fall, the two counts, and all that stuff. But the match itself is not bad.
No.
Oh, not at all. I agree. Good match. I still don't understand. Did they ever explain why Kimberly had no problem with Jeff Jarrett hitting her with a guitar the week before?
And that's a Russo staple, is that she would give motivation for why she went after DDP, because he's selfish, because he didn't care about anyone but himself. He never paid her enough attention. She should be the star, yada, yada. But Russo swerves, they would always explain why they were mad at the person they attacked, but they would never say why they forgave the person who had attacked them. I think you were always just supposed to assume that it was part of the master plan, and they did not mind taking some abuse. And,
I'll take a concussion.
Whatever. Yeah, exactly.
And that's why Russo always needed a Vince McMahon to come in and say, look, we got to tie this up somehow in a bow. Exactly. Even if we abandon it a month later, we got to make it make some kind of sense.
Did you guys catch when Bischoff and Kimberly were doing the whole like hugging each other thing after the match, how the announcers actually made reference to the internet rumors of the swinging couples in WCW? Yeah.
I thought it was great. I was glad they did that for some reason.
Are you talking about those Gold's Gym rumors?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
either Tony or
the Gold Club.
You remember that old time with the Gold's Gym?
Yeah, Bischoff having, you know, his
that's the old Gold's Gym event where I said Gold's Gym instead of Gold Club.
Oh, my. Oh, yeah. What a throwback there. Yeah. But yeah, no, I thought it was a nice touch. It was, you know, yeah, they're neighbors. They clearly, this is what they do on Sunday afternoons anyways. But, oh man. So that's the show. I have some, before we go home here, and I think, you know, we did some impressive speed records in terms of covering a lot of topics. In a small amount of time.
Literally.
there's a few more bigger questions I want to talk about. First of all, I want to ask you guys, because we just touched on it now about DDP Jarrett being good, but we also talked about some of the other matches. On a night where, as we said, the matches didn't seem like the most important thing, what was your best match of the night, Andrew?
Sting and Booker T.
Yeah. Greg, would you agree?
I mean, Booker.
Sting and Booker as well for me.
Yeah, clean sweep. I thought that. And you know what? You know what reason I thought was because in every other match, even DDP Jarrett, which was pretty good, the storyline was so encompassing. It was so heavily New Blood against Millionaires Club that it was hard. And that's not a bad thing. That's what they were doing. They were pushing a storyline. But in terms of just enjoying a wrestling match, Booker Sting was one where, because Booker wasn't a diehard New Blood guy, it really did feel like, all right, these are two guys just out there having a wrestling match. There's not a story so much. And I think it may have, I don't have it in front of me, it may have been the longest match of the night. Jarrett DDP may have been longer.
I think Jarrett DDP may have hit it in terms of time. I think it was about 15 minutes.
But to your point, I think it felt like Sting and Booker was the longest match because it felt like they did more in their time. Like they really – they worked a complete wrestling match.
It was the old-fashioned go out and have a good match.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, something else. Andrew, you talked about this way at the beginning. I had to pump the brakes, but I want to get to it now. So as you alluded – at the beginning of 2000, when Kevin Sullivan took the book from Vince Russo, Chris Benoit, Eddie Guerrero, Dean Malenko, and Perry Saturn ended up jumping from WCW to the WWF. They became the Radicals, and they had success there. The reasons there being, you know, Benoit had heat with Sullivan over basically breaking up Sullivan's marriage to woman, and other reasons. I think they all felt kind of like Russo was their chance to get pushed in WCW, and if he was gone, so was their shot, and they decided to take a shot up north. But you said this New Blood angle was done with a depleted roster, because those were the stalwarts of the WCW mid-card. Those were the young guys who people would have bought as stars. If that doesn't happen, if the Radicals don't bolt for the WWF, if Bischoff and Russo have access to Benoit, Guerrero, Malenko, Saturn, and, you know, even Conan, Mysterio, some of the other guys who got kind of caught up there. I'm not going to go so far as to say Jericho, because I think Jericho was long gone at this point. But those guys are in the mix. How different a show is this, and how different direction-wise do you think WCW gets?
Well, first of all, Chris Benoit would have been the WCW champion.
Yeah.
Because they were booking him as, like, their work rate, you know, working man's champion the moment Bret Hart got the concussion, because they had already given him the U.S. belt going into 2000, and he was going to be the champion. He was the champion that sold out when he beat Sid,
right.
But he dropped it anyway so that he can get out of his contract when the option was open to him. So he was going to be that guy. The one thing, it is a double-edged sword though, Ben, because they still had those guys in 1999, right. And they didn't really do much with them anyway. You know, they had the Revolution, they broke up, they would have matches against one another, and no one really remembers them. And the Filthy Animals, they would have matches against one another, and no one really remembers them. Now, would they have been able to have good matches at the top had Eddie and Benoit and Saturn and Malenko had still been around, and they would be able to have good matches against guys like a Hulk Hogan or a Diamond Dallas Page or a Ric Flair? Yeah, we may have seen some great stuff. Like, Bret and Benoit had some really good matches, you know, in late 99 while Russo was booking the show. So, very different complexion, a little more meat and potatoes in the main event spot, but I think the failure would have been just as profound.
Right, I agree with you. I don't necessarily know where they slot in. I think you make a good point about maybe Benoit takes Jarrett's spot, and that, of course, changes history, as you talked about, in a bigger way. But yeah, I don't think they were going to push Guerrero, and certainly not Saturn and Malenko, over even, you know, Vampiro.
I mean, Benoit was clearly the diamond in the rough.
Right.
Clearly. He goes to the WWF and he gets shot to the moon.
I would argue Guerrero was the diamond in the rough. Benoit was the diamond they already knew they had.
Okay.
So there's something more to there.
Excellent point.
Greg, what do you think?
You know, it's weird because I want to say that if they had stuck around, that probably Benoit would have gotten put into the Jarrett role, and maybe, or if not Guerrero. But if you like, I was going to bring up the same point that Andrew just mentioned. When Russo took over in late '99, he didn't do much with Benoit. Jarrett was his guy. Yeah, and Jarrett was his dude. He put Benoit in a position to have great matches against Bret Hart, but Benoit never won those matches. Benoit was established clearly as a U.S. or TV title level guy. And with Eddie, I mean, they had a weird feud with Ric Flair, with the Filthy Animals, and it didn't seem like they really had much in store for Eddie either. And it's weird because if you look at all these guys on paper, Eddie would seem like the perfect guy for Russo because he can talk, he can do the character, wild character stuff. But I just wonder if Russo would have ever recognized that. So yeah. I think the matches would have been better because all of those guys, even Saturn, were workhorses and could go. So I think the matches would have been better in WCW. I think the fans would have bought into the new blood more if they had those guys there, because the WCW fans always respected Benoit, always respected Eddie especially, and always respected Saturn. So I think that those guys would have been positioned to have good matches and to have crowd reactions. I just don't think that – I'm not convinced that Russo would have bought into them as main eventers.
Yeah, and we remember a lot with the New Blood, Booker T having his moment. You know, imagine if Eddie or Benoit or Malenko was the one who had their moment. Maybe it wouldn't have transferred over to the WWF or the WWE universe in terms of their perception of that performer as like a legit guy, but it would have gone a long way for him compared to what they had to do in the WWE when they got there.
Yeah. Some interesting takes on that, guys. All right, I want to ask one more question before we get out of here, and I really enjoyed this, and I'm glad we picked the show. I'll be honest, I was a little nervous about it, but I think we were able to tackle it in a fun way. We talked about how we reacted to this show at the time in 2000 when we were watching it. Say, very hypothetically, this is a show, this style of show, this takeover, this craziness. Say you see this again today. I mean, you did see it. You saw it this past week or 2 weeks ago when you were rewatching it. Would you look at this and be like, you know what? Like, just try to put it in a vacuum. This is a promotion I'm interested in watching because this was intended to be a reset button. This was intended to be the first big show of the new WCW. So say you're presented with this show. You don't know anything. Try to put aside your biases or anything else, just based on the matches, the angles, the craziness, the authority figures, the swerves. Is this a promotion you're interested in following? Or from this show alone, do you start to say, you know what, I don't know if this is necessarily for me? Greg, why don't we give you the first shot here?
It hurts me to say this, but you mentioned I have to throw aside my biases and my mm-hmm. preconceived mm-hmm. notions. But looking at this show in a vacuum, I would absolutely want nothing to do with this promotion. Mm-hmm. I'd probably still watch it because it's wrestling.
Yeah,
but I would not be happily. I would not be. Yeah, I would not be invested in the show at all.
What about you, Reesh? Is this something that would have piqued your interest?
You know, it's a little bit of a schism for me too, because, you know, it's hard to differentiate in the eye of the beholder the difference between so bad it's good and so bad it's bad. You know, and you kind of have to take the good with the awful in some of these cases. The reason why I would invite it more in today's age is because if you watch the mainstay wrestling programming, even on like TNA on Destination America, it's all so bland. The booking is so by the numbers. And you just almost like, it's almost like when Nexus showed up and attacked the WWE roster in 2010. And sometimes you just want that punch in the face, you know, like a shock to the system, like you called it. And can you do a shock to the system every week, every month on your promotion without it kind of being desensitized to your fans? No, that wouldn't work for you, but I would like to watch a wrestling promotion where something happens all the time. So if that means I have to take the awful wrestling, then I'll accept it. And I'd say that I would definitely invite something like this.
You raise an interesting point, because I think my issue would be if this Spring Stampede show were a Nitro, I would have been totally fine with it. But it being a pay-per-view, like, that tells me that this is the best that this company has to offer for my money. And I would, if I were watching this in a vacuum, I'd be like, I really don't feel like I got my money's worth on this.
Performance context-wise, absolutely not. Like, there's nothing in here. There's only one, maybe like two good matches that came out of any of these shows. I think one of them was Steiner and Goldberg at Fall Brawl. You know, there really weren't a lot of really great actual matches when Russo was running WCW. But so you're not going to get great matches, but let's be honest. How many great matches are you watching in the WWE? I mean, like, really true standout matches. Like, the talent's good, but, you know, the matches can fall really flat. And sometimes, if that means that I get awful wrestling, but a lot of crazy stuff, I'll take the crazy stuff.
I think that that kind of sums it up. Awful wrestling, crazy stuff. Spring Stampede 2000 was that kind of show. Andrew, Greg, thank you guys for joining me on this look back into the Russo-Bischoff era. Who knows, maybe we'll revisit this on a future episode of PTBN Rewind. As for next month, we will definitely have a new topic, a new show, a new panel, but these guys were great, and you know, you guys will definitely be back in the future. Until next time, please, this is Ben Moore saying, be kind, rewind, and we will catch you on the next PTBN Rewind.
Wait, guys, we forgot to talk about Man Cow.
Oh my gosh, how are we going to live?